This is Mae Warren. Today is the 4th of October, 1996. I'm in Lexington, Virginia, and I'm with Al Fleischman. And I'm just real tickled to finally get with you. I've heard wonderful things about ZBT. And at this point, you are Mr. ZBT, so I would like you to speak on behalf of all your brothers who went before you and who came after you and who were there with you. So what first attracted you to Washington and Lee?
I got to Washington and Lee sort of by chance of fate. When I was in high school, I graduated from high school in 1937, and most of the people who would be on the other end of this can't relate to those days, but we didn't have the kind of communication or information about places. Like everybody else, I was in South Carolina, which was a very poor state in those days. I can remember as a child, when I was 7 years old, my mother had an open Buick touring car, and I rode in the parade with her and some other people in the car that celebrated the 100th anniversary of the founding of Anderson, South Carolina, where I was born. In the parade, marching in front of us were some Confederate veterans, believe it or not. So I go back a long way. The South was very poor. My great uncles came down there in the 1880s as peddlers, pack peddlers, and they found towns that they liked, and they established a storehouse, and it became a store. And the Fleischman family had 15 or 20 stores and towns in South Carolina, North Carolina, and Georgia, long before most of the chains were in business. Belk's and Sears and Penny's and people like that weren't even heard of yet. And that my father was born in Baltimore, Maryland, and he came down to work for his uncles when he was 12 years old in Anderson. And my father grew up there working for his Uncle Sam, who was my great uncle, whom I knew. And he was drafted in World War I, was overseas in France, and he came back home. And in those days, among the Jewish people, they generally arranged marriages like you've heard about in the books, and Fiddler on the Roof and things like that. And my father married my mother, who he had been set up to marry. And I was born in Anderson, South Carolina, about a year and a half after they were married. And I've lived there ever since. I got to Washington Lee. I was in the local high school and did real well. I was fortunate enough to be valedictorian in my class, which was very unusual because there were only 3 or 4 Jewish kids in the high school at that time. And we received, I know a little something about discrimination and about things like that and prejudice. And I was fortunate enough to do that. And when I started thinking about colleges, there were 4 that interested me. University of North Carolina, because some of my relatives had gone there. Duke University, because I heard what a wonderful school it was. And Citadel, poor me, I would have never been anything at the Citadel. I would have blown the place up, wound up in the brig, because that wasn't my kind of place. And our attorney, a man named Leon L. Harris, who was class of 15 at Washington and Lee, was the family attorney and the store attorney, and Mr. Harris used to tell me about Washington Lee, and it sounded real interesting to me. I had never seen the place, so he suggested that I apply. And the reason I came to Washington Lee, I was pushing in those days, it wasn't a question of acceptance, you just showed up with the money and went to school. And I received a letter from Washington Lee indicating that I would get a $100 scholarship against the tuition. And none of the others made that offer, and that's the reason I came. The tuition to Washington Lee my freshman year was $250. And the other 3 years, it was $300 a year. And I was fortunate enough to have scholarships all 3 years, so all the other 3 years. So the only tuition I paid was $150 the first year I came here. Does that tell you how I got to Washington Lee?
That's a pretty good indication. Well, did you visit the campus before you came?
Never saw the place. I came, my mother and father, and we had a gentleman who used to work for him who used to drive it on long trips. They drove me up here in our family car, which was a 1928 Buick. And they left me here. I'd never been away from home for any length of time. I was 16. We only had 11 grades, and I was a little younger than most of the people here. And I was in room 316 in Graham Dormitory. And I was there by myself waiting to go to freshman camp. We used to have freshman camp here when I was here, and it was a wonderful thing because we had 3 or 4 days out at, I think it was Cave Mountain Lake, it's wherever the Boy Scout camp was in those days. And there were about 150 of my classmates, and we all had wore name tags, and we learned to know who was which, and we had all the people from the school speak to us, Dean Gillum, and of course Dr. Gaines, and 3 or 4 other the dignitaries told us about Washington Lee and what life at Washington Lee was like and what the academics were like. And the first day there, I still hear from two of those people that I've seen them at our reunions. Charlie Gilbert and Don Godine is going to be back for this reunion. We were in the same bunk in the it was alphabetical, and I was scared to death. And the first day I had a terrible pain in the side, which I'm sure was psychological, because I just didn't know anybody and didn't want to be away from home. One thing I forgot to tell you though, when I was in the dormitory, as soon as I checked in, one of the representatives of Phi Epsilon Pi, which was the other Jewish fraternity, we had Phi Epsilon, Phi Ep, and we had ZBT with the two Jewish fraternities. They knocked at the door and were real nice to me and took me to lunch. And then at the fellow named Robert E. Lee, believe it or not, was in my class. And I don't know if he was related to the other Robert E. Lee, but probably. We used to call him Buzz. And he was the guy that won the blanket. He got a Washington Lee blanket for naming most people that were in the freshman class on the last day. I was second. And I don't think I got any prize, but he got a wonderful blanket that I remember. And then also, as we were standing in line for registration, there was a great big guy standing next to me, and I'll never forget it. He had on a wine-colored, or brown, I guess, herringbone tweed suit. And I looked at him, and I thought, well, this looks like might be a fellow to be friendly with. And this was Marvin Stanley Winter, who was also Jewish. He was from New York. And he became a very close friend of mine, and still is. When we got back, of course, we were busy with registration, and I'll never forget Dr. Gaines' speech down in Lee Chapel when he introduced started telling us some of the things. The rest of the class, the other 100 people that weren't there, we had like 280 in our class. The other 100 people who weren't at freshman camp were all there. We came a few days early for orientation. And I'll never forget when he mentioned the University of Virginia, he never called it by the name. He said that the school over the hill from us in Charlottesville, whose team will be so soundly beat by us, whatever day was coming up. We also had the wonderful opportunity of hearing Cy Young talk. And Cy Young's mother-in-law was our house mother, Miss Neely. And so we were close to Cy Young, and I still see Cy's son, Neely Young, once in a while. Of course, he was named for the family that Miss Neely was part of. It was a whole different thing than the traditions were very well, represented. Of course, we did, again, like I said, we didn't have the communication or the ability to do some of the things. We had a great newspaper, and I'd been on a high school newspaper, and I thought that would be a good thing for me to do. And so I applied to become a reporter, and I worked for the Ringtown File 4 years I was here. Eventually, in my quest to do things that people didn't always like, I decided we should the big entertainment in those days was the state theater. And so we used to call, everybody was on the show team, are you on the show team today? And most of the fraternity brothers used to go to the movies as soon as it changed. So I thought that would be a good thing. So I wrote a column called Reviews and Previews in the newspaper, and they wondered how I ever saw those movies, and I never saw any of them. I used to get the poop sheet that they had, which had the information in advance, the advance sheet, and a wonderful man named Ralph Daves was manager of the theater, and he was the son-in-law of a man named Ike Weinberg, who was sort of our patron saint at ZBT. Mr. Weinberg owns a couple businesses in town and also several buildings. And he helped us to build a fraternity house. Of course, I was rushed by ZBT. And if you want this information, ma'am, I'll tell you about that rush week.
Please do.
All right, we had two Jewish fraternities here. There were 19 fraternities, I think. when I was there. And everybody, this was something else that bothered people. There were no upper-class dormitories. See, if you didn't belong to a fraternity, you'd have some room out in town. And we didn't have any of these facilities that you have here today. Even when the young ladies used to come for the dances, they had to stay in boarding houses. There were no motels or hotels. Well, the Robert E. Lee was the only thing. And so when we had Rush, the FIAPS, in my class was a man named Bert Shewell, who was very famous here at Washington Lee, and he was raised a lot of money for them, and he was a great donor, and his family owned the Shewell Furniture Stores, which are still in Virginia, and his son's still a part of it, and he and his father and his father's brother, I think, were the people that ran it, and they were very big Washington Lee supporters. But they were also supporters of Phi Epsilon Pi, which was the other Jewish fraternity. So at the end of the, also there was a quota system here. They allowed 50 Jewish young men to be in the total population of 1,000, because there were 5% of the population of Jewish people in the United States was 5% of the total. So we had a quota. We all knew it. Of course, nobody talked about it, but we knew that there was a quota as to how many Jewish young men could be here. And so there were 15 young Jewish fellows in my class when we registered, and of course the FIAPS and the ZBTs rushed us. They didn't rush anybody that was non-Jewish. When they came to select the pledges, 13 of the 15 a pledged ZBT, one pledged FIAP, and one remained non-fraternity. Of the 13 pledges, one was Bert Shewell, and in whose family had supported FIAP so strongly. So there was a big hullabaloo, and his father and his uncle got the other fraternity to protest the dirty Rush. So they had two more days of Rush, and it wound up ZBT got 12, and FIAP got Bert Shewell and Bob Younger, and the other guy, Marion Simon, didn't pledge, but he pledged our fraternity the next year. Thought that might be of interest to you. And, of course, the fraternity life was an entirely new thing. And in those days, the pledges were, well, like servants. My pledge master was a man named Jim Fischel, who was class of 39, who became a big-time advertising executive. And he's still alive. I see him when I go to New York. He's in poor physical shape. He was on the tennis team, and he was a great person. And he was, incidentally, the first Jewish editor of any major publication here on the Washington Lee campus. He was added to the Southern Collegiate his senior year. And getting back to the Ringtone Phi, I worked on it all 4 years. And I don't know whether you want to use this or not. We used to have something called the Big Click here, which were you've heard about that before, which were the six major fraternities. I may not have all of them right. ATO, which is no longer here. Phi Delta Theta, Beta Theta Pi, most of them is Sigma Nu, Kappa Alpha, and I think maybe Kappa Sig, I don't know. But they were, and I'm not sure about Sigma Nu, maybe Sigma Chi, but anyway, there were six major fraternities out of the 19. Also, when I came here, this is incidental too, ZBT was last in scholarship. Our class brought them from last to first in 1 year. We were first in scholarship at the end of our freshman year. And we stayed first to second in scholarship for the 4 years I was here. We had three members of my class who were Phi Beta Kappa, which was very unusual out of those 12 pledges I was telling you about.
When you say first in scholarship, you mean you had the highest grade point
average?
Yeah, it
was 3-point average. And they used to, I don't know whether they still do that among the fraternities here or not, but I just saw it in the old Ringtone Phi, what we were at the end of the time. And anyway, I finish up this thing with the Ringtone Phi. We had a young man on who was a freshman with us, whose father was a very famous typographer named Gilbert Farrow. Fred Farrow was in our class. And Fred was a reporter with us, but he dropped out after the first year or two, and Fred was a Beta Theta Pi. We wound up with three, and I don't know whether you want to use this or not, because it's controversial, I guess, but this is how I saw it. We wound up, we had three Lambda Chi's who were almost as low grade as a ZBT. We had one ZBT and one non-fraternity person who was who were the major staff my junior year, and from whom the editorship had been selected. And there was an ATO who was editor, who I won't tell you his name, and he decided that because of the big click arrangements that they bring Fred Farrer back and make Fred the editor. And the other five of us got together, and I guess I was the lead in that crowd. I told you I'm always protesting. I was the lead in that crowd, and we decided that we would resign from the Ringtone Fire, and they wouldn't have a newspaper if they didn't elect Bill Buchanan editor. He was non-fraternity, had no political clout at all. So Bill Buchanan, who became the head of your Department of Political Science here, or whatever they call it, politics, and still lives in Lexington, was elected editor because the other four of us decided that was the thing to do. And the person who had been selected, and you better not use his name now, Fred Farrer, because he hates me anyway, I think he does, was not elected editor, publication board. So that was one coup that we felt we were able to do. Anyway, getting back to the Ringtone Fire, we did a lot of unusual things, and when I found out we didn't have upper-class dormitories, we only had freshman dormitories, just Graham and Lee. We had no place for the upperclassmen to live at all except the fraternity houses. And as I told you, something like 85%, it's still a high percentage here, of the people belong to fraternities. And it, of course, was all male. So I wrote an editorial about upper-class dorms. And when I was the happiest I could be when they decided to build that upper class dorm, which was like 30 years later. And the other thing that I did, I had been in the high school band when I was here, when I was in high school. And when I got to Washington, we had a pretty good football team. We used to play big time football. We played people like Duke, West Virginia, North Carolina, Tennessee, some of the big name schools in this area. And, because we were a little bitty school, and we used to win a game every now and then. And some of my best friends are people off the football team today. Junie Bishop was the fullback, and Junie made Phi Beta Kappa, and I thought that was absolutely wonderful. And he's always said, and he'll be back for this. He's somebody else you may want to talk to, because he was a football player. He'll be back for our reunion. He'll be here today. And when Junie used to go on the football trips, he missed the days in class, and I always lend him my notes. I went over the notes. My notes from class with him and helped him whenever I could, which he's a pretty smart fella. And he's always said the reason that he made Phi Beta Kappa was because of my notes, which I don't believe. But anyway, he and I have been close all these years, and I've seen him in all kinds of places. But I figured Washington Lee needed to have a band. And we didn't have a band, ragtag, sort of like they got now. And so I helped organize a band, and we had a 40-piece band, and we used to march and travel with the football team. And we got some uniforms. I don't remember how I raised the money for the uniforms, but we got uniforms. And we went all over the country with them. One of the games that I remembered, we played Maryland in that Baltimore City Stadium where the Baltimore Colts used to play. It held like 55,000 people. And you know where I'm talking
about. Memorial Stadium.
Yeah, and they had, I think Notre Dame used to play Navy there. So anyway, it was in November. I think it was the last game of the season. It may have been Thanksgiving or the weekend after, the weekend before. And it was very cold, and it snowed like the devil. And we marched in our little lightweight uniforms in that snow with snow up to our ankles. And it was so cold, in fact, before the game ended, they brought the buses out on the field for the football teams to sit in while they weren't out on the field, and we almost froze to death. There could have been over 500 people in that 50,000 stadium. Uh-huh. Remember that? But anyway, I was very proud of that we had a band, and we had a man named Varner who was the music director before you had a good music department like you have today. And let's see what else do I need to. I'm rambling. I don't know what else.
No, you're doing great.
All right. Well, let me see what else I remember. I don't remember a lot about the freshman year. I remember that we in our fraternity was last at intramurals, and we brought it way up. I don't know where we were, fifth or sixth, after we had a lot of people who were interested in sports, and all of us played. I don't know what I was doing out there. We used to play tag football, and the ATOs were always the top crowd because they were the ones that had the real football players, and they helped the other guys. And we had a great ping pong team, that much I remember. We were good at ping pong.
Tell me about what life was like in the fraternity house.
Well, it's what you make it. Now, that's the way I looked at those things. I never drank. I was always the guy that drove the car, even before they told you to have a driver. And I was always the person that was the bartender. I tended the bar. I didn't care anything about the alcoholic beverages particularly. Not that I had any scruples. It just didn't do anything for me. The first house party that I remember, the ZBT house used to be on Jackson Avenue, if you know where the Five Game House is today. Right across the street from the Five Game House. The house is still there. That was our first, I'll tell you about that too. That was our first fraternity house, and it only had room for about 10 or 12 people to sleep there. And we decided we needed a bigger and larger house. And my freshman year, Jim Fischel, Alec Lowe, a man named Ned Brower, who's passed away, and two, we had a fellow named Luria here, whose family was the Luria Iron and Steel people from up in Reading, Pennsylvania, who sold a lot of scrap steel, and they had lots of money even then. And we decided we would build a new fraternity house. So we got together, and we raised $5,000 from the parents and alumni, and Mr. Weinberg signed a note for us for another $5,000, and the university lent us $15,000 and gave us the land. We built a fraternity house for $30,000.
And where was that?
My sophomore year, 1938, we got in the house. We started in 37, started the drive when I first got here. And the ZBT house now, I think it's the Kappa Sig house across from Lambda Chi's, because ZBT is no longer on the campus.
And where is it on the campus?
It's on Nelson Street.
On Nelson Street.
On your way out toward the shopping centers.
Mm-hmm.
Right before you get there, the hospital is up there, I think, to the right someplace, right before you get there. Anyway, I was on that committee too because I could type. See, a lot of those fancy brothers of mine didn't ever take typing because they were all going to be big executives. I took typing when I was in high school. So I typed many of the letters, most of them, I guess, that got us the money. And ZBT was like any other group of people. You have some people that were introverts and some that were extroverts. I guess you'd call me an extrovert. I'm not too sure exactly what that meant, but I was always involved in stuff, and then I used to study a lot, but not in the fraternity house because it was hard to do there. And the first year I was in that house, didn't get finished until about the fall of 38. I moved in as a sophomore with my roommates were Charlie Tallheimer and Gene Friedberg, and you know Tallheimer from the stores. Charlie was the son of Mr. William Tallheimer, who was president of Tallheimer. And they were convivial, and they had their things that they did, and I had the things that I did. And I used to do my studying mostly after supper. I'll show you sometime if you want to, in the old Commerce Building, which is your philosophy and religion building now, psychology, politics, I guess. I'm not sure what it is. Newcomb Hall.
Mm-hmm.
And the library was up there, the Commerce Library, and that's where I used to study. And they always made fun of it. They said they're going to put a plaque on the wall over that seat that I sat in for 3 years. But that's where I'd be every night. And that's when I did my studying, when it was quiet.
What was your major?
I majored in accounting, but I took everything in the Commerce School we had except two courses. The only courses I didn't take, and I was sorry that I didn't take it, was one called Investments, taught by a man named Lou Adams. And the other was inland transportation, which I'm just as glad I missed. I didn't care anything about that anyway, but sorry I didn't take the investments course. It would have helped me.
Were there any faculty members who were particularly important to you?
Yeah. Lewis K. Johnson. Have you heard that name before?
Tell me about it.
Well, Lewis K. Johnson taught us marketing, and I teach marketing today at a community college, and I use his precepts every day. He said some wonderful things, and anybody that ever took marketing from L.K. Johnson will remember him because he meant a lot to us, and he was here for a long time. He was nice enough to invite me to his retirement dinner where after 40 years, and the same Bert Shull that I told you about made the speech at the retirement dinner, and Bert was a real character, had wonderful stories to tell about anything, everything. Of course, he took the courses too from him. And he had this old beat-up watch that he was wrapped in a beautiful package that he gave to Dr. Johnson as a gift. And we had a silver tray, which he had under the table, that we all had signed, that was in the silver with our names on it. Everybody was there. And it was really something he presented. But Dr. Johnson and I were friends forever. And he was in the Navy, too. I was in the Navy during World War II. And when I got back to the States after a year and a half in the South Pacific, I was fortunate enough to be on a destroyer, unfortunate enough to get back without anything happening. But we participated in every landing in the Solomons from Guadalcanal to Bougainville. My ship had 11 battle stars, 2 unit citations, and thank the Lord it wasn't hit a single time. But anyway, when I got back to the States, I'll back up a little bit. When I graduated, I was a real dumb bunny, a damn fool. I had a 2-year scholarship to the Harvard Business School and didn't take it. Yeah. Get the pistols out, shoot yourself on both sides. But World War II was on the way, and I was terribly in love with somebody, and I could see whether that would interfere with me going into the Navy, which I planned to do, and the other part. So anyway, after I came back, I was a supply officer. I was in the second supply class at Harvard Business School that the Navy had, and I left for the South Pacific in September 1942. They landed at Guadalcanal August the 7th of 42, and I was out there a few weeks later. And when I finished my service as a supply officer, they didn't have supply officers on destroyers, which I was on. They would have a supply officer for a squadron or a division of ships. And I was a supply officer for 2 ships and down to 1, and it was considered hazardous duty because it was sinking like 2 of those things a week when I was out there. So when I got back, the supply corps was nice enough to suggest that they would give me some kind of duty that I wanted, which almost made me faint. And by then I was a lieutenant, full lieutenant. And so I requested any Navy Yard on the East Coast, and I got the Philadelphia Navy Yard. In the meantime, when I was on that ship, whenever anything came across, they had requests like you were telling me about what you saw in the Rockbridge Gazette, the Lexington Gazette, or whatever it is now. They used to advertise for people who had certain specialties. And of course, my accounting specialty was something I thought was pretty good. So I sent in an application, never heard anything. Like in May of 43, never heard anything. So when I got back to the States, I left the following February. After I got my leave, I was stationed at Philadelphia Navy Yard, and I'd been there about 30 days when they called me from the personnel office, and they said, "Lieutenant Fleischman, we got a set of orders for you." I said, "How the hell can you have orders for me? I just got back. I've only been back 3 months." They said, "Well, we got orders." And so I went up there, and it was orders to the Harvard Business School. It was a new program that they had called Navy Material Redistribution and Disposal Administration. And our job was to be, as the war was winding down, this was in 44, they could see the end of the war was imminent, that we would do the contract termination and pay off the contractors and get rid of the surplus of whatever they had and get them back into civilian production. So I had 4 months up at Harvard, and I was able to get a degree from the business school after all.
That's great.
isn't that a good story? And it really happened. And then I finished World War II, of all places, in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
That's great. Now, when we were talking on the phone, you told me a couple of terrific stories about running into Washington.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'll tell you about some of those, too. But I started to tell you about Junie Bishop. I was telling you about was a football player.
Uh-huh.
When I was at Harvard, the first trip in the supply school, I was standing on the corner waiting across the street on the Harvard Business School campus. I don't know if you've ever been there, and I don't know what it looks like now. This was in 1944, I guess. 44, yeah. And these Air Force people were there too. Off we go in the Wild Blue Yonder, and that was Junie Bishop walking across the, and I went up to him, and of course he was in ranks, he couldn't say anything. Art Smith, who's a member of my class, I was sitting with a load of supplies on a miserable island named Espiritu Santo. It wasn't all miserable. South Pacific that was the island that was the model for South Pacific. That, you know who, the guy that wrote all the Oh, he wrote all that stuff, including Chesapeake.
Michener.
Huh?
Michener.
Yeah, that's right, Michener. And we knew where the Frenchman lived, and we knew what Bally High was. That was an island called Savo Island that they used to call Bally High. But anyway, also I was sitting on a load of supplies with my working party waiting for the ship, for my boat to take us back to that ship, and here comes this fella I could see a Jeep coming down, and about from his waist up was above his, keep the windshields down, his waist up above the Jeep, and that was Art Smith down. I can't remember, I'm sorry.
That's okay, go ahead.
And
so you were
I
in the
saw,
Jeep.
I wasn't in the Jeep. I was sitting on with a load of supplies on this miserable island at a dock, in the boondocks, really boondocks, waiting for our boat to pick us up. We'd bought gotten some food from one of the warehouses there. And I saw this Jeep coming down the road, and it was this tall fell above it, and I said, that's got to be Art Smith. Nobody else is that tall. And I got out in the middle of the road and stopped the Jeep, and sure enough, it was Art Smith. I was standing on the bridge of our ship as we came into an island. Samoa. We were in Samoa, in the Fiji Islands. And I was waiting for the captain to give me orders as to what to do, and I stand on the bridge beside the, while the captain was bringing the ship alongside a cruiser, and there on the bridge of the cruiser was a classmate of mine named Johnny Preston, who passed away. I used to see him all over, and I got to get back into Lewis K. Johnson, to Dr. Johnson, all those wonderful things that he taught me. Dr. Johnson was stationed in New York City in the Naval Officer Procurement Office, and his job was to get recruits for the naval officers. And I knew, found out he was there, and I went to see him, and he and I had dinner. I was stationed in New York for about 6 or 8 weeks while I was in this new program being acclimated to what the paperwork was like. And he and I used to eat dinner together quite often, maybe every other night when we were in New York. And he anybody that ever had him for classes loved him. He was a wonderful, wonderful man. And he taught us a heck of a lot. The other professor that I remember, I had a wonderful, and maybe you've heard of him, you had an English professor here named Fitzgerald Flournoy. You ever hear of them, the Flournoys?
Tell me about him.
Okay, well, Dr. Flournoy was a real character. He was rather rotund, and he wore the most miserable clothes I guess I ever saw. And since I've been teaching at a college, I can understand why he did, because there's certain things that happen. You never know what the weather's going to be, and you leave early in the morning. You don't know when you're going to get home. But anyway, he taught us freshman English. And Dr. Flournoy, I can remember him now, telling us about Gilbert Keith Chesterton's Lepanto, dim drums throbbing in the hill, half heard, and he'd bang on the lectern. And he had a wonderful way of talking. The other thing I remember about Dr. Flournoy, we had Benny Goodman here for Fancy Dress, 1939, I guess, and in the old Doremus Gymnasium, and he was on the upper deck where that little track is that they run around. If it's still there, I haven't been in Doremus lately. And he was, I remember watching him right above the band, beating time to the music, banging on the metal rails around while Benny Goodman's band was playing. But he was a very interesting character. I also had Larry Watkins for Business English, and that was the man that wrote On Bar of Time. You remember about him, I'm sure, you, since you're an English person, you know all about that stuff. He was a pretty famous man. The other thing we had, I had, trying to remember some of them, Dr. Tucker, who was the dean of the university for a while, and of course he was head of the Commerce School, but Dr. Tucker taught us a transportation course. I don't remember exactly what it was, but it was about railroad and truck transportation. The inland transportation course was more about and he also had a taxation course that we took from him. We had Mr. Dr. Hancock. I think he got a building name for him or something, Glover Dunn Hancock. He used to be in the old Newcomb Hall. He taught me money and banking, which is probably the toughest course I had while I was here. And I had a man that I got a real kick out of. I was fortunate enough to only made one B while I was here. Everything else was A's except for I didn't do very well on my physical ed, but that wasn't important. That didn't count anyway. because I wouldn't show up half the time. And I had other things to do that I figured were more important. But this was a man named Bob Gray that taught business law. And I figured up my grades based on the way we were told on the syllabus as to how they were going to be figured. At the end of the first semester, he had given me a B, and I figured my grade was 93, and I went to see him. And I showed him what it was, and he says, well, you got it. I said, aren't you going to change it? He says, well, you did get an A. He says, well, let's call it tomorrow late. And that was the only B I got. And I don't know whether this is true or not, but somebody at Washington Lee told me this, that Bob Gray was picked up by the Secret Service, the FBI, whatever it was, for being a Nazi sympathizer. I don't know whether that's true or not. Huh. So, you know, I would be paranoid, and I probably am about a lot of things, that among them. Where were we? Talking about professors, weren't we?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, who else do I remember very well? Let's see, Hancock. Dr. Royster, who just died recently, taught us math. Who else were my freshman teachers? I'm trying to remember who else I had.
Was there anybody who was really exciting in the classroom?
Oh, yeah, Johnson was exciting. Oh, I tell you who else was exciting. We had a man named M.O. Phillips, Merton Ogden Phillips. He taught us some natural resources, something like that. Business and resources, some course like that. And he was very exciting in the classroom, M.O. Phillips. And the most exciting class I was lucky enough, Dr. Gaines would pick 25 students that he would teach a philosophy course to every year. They were juniors and seniors. Have you heard this before?
Tell me about it.
Have you heard it before?
Tell me about it.
I'm telling you about it. Okay. Dr. Gaines, of course, he was gone a lot of the time. But it was called The Bible as Literature, and I'll never forget it. I still have the textbook. It's very, very interesting. Wonderful, wonderful course, you can imagine, with him in a classroom. What else? I remember Gillum pretty well. I had geology, too, from, I'm trying to remember, that they had two people in the, our geology department, even then, was known all over the country. And our classroom was in Washington Hall. There was a lecture room that held like 100 people. That was the biggest class I had while I was at Washington Lee as far as numbers. And I can still remember the geologic time scale if you want that recited.
Well, tell me about Dr. Gaines, the teacher.
Oh, he was just wonderful. He had wonderful stories about everything. And philosophy, he had wonderful philosophy. We were discussing some part of the Bible, and he was talking about Islamic, Mohammedanism is what it was called in my day, about the view of the female. And I'll never forget that. He said the Mohammedans believe that females' bodies should be completely covered sometimes, but the main thing that they leave uncovered is the eyes. He says, after all, that's the thing that's mostly different about people. You can see a lot about their eyes. And he said, they weren't so dumb after all. He said, the rest of the bodies are pretty much the same except different proportions. I remember that part. He didn't say it exactly like that. But he was an interesting man. He had a wonderful, wonderful philosophy, a lot of things. And see, he came from my part of the country. He was from Due West, South Carolina. I don't know that he went to school at Erskine, but his family there's still some people down there that are related to him that come in once in a while and say hello to me and tell me about Dr. Gaines.
Oh.
Believe it or not. And I've met the W&L people all over the world, every place I've been. And it's always something. This last time, since I've been at this Tri-County Tech, where I'm an adjunct faculty member, I tell them I'm adjunct to the faculty, I teach the marketing courses, and as I told you, I mention LK all the time, because he's had one, he had a couple things. He's tell the employee and tell him why, and you can eliminate a middleman, but you can't eliminate his function, and you can't cross the crowd. Those are three of his statements that I use over and over and over again, which are true in marketing, no question about it. But anyway, since I've been at that tech school, I organized a trip to New York to take students to New York City. And, of course, Washington Lee has helped me there, too. we think anywhere from 20, most we've ever had is 38, and that's too many. Last year we had 22. And Marvin Winter's son, they have a big real estate operation. They bought a building on 57th Street. If you know New York City, it's on 57th and 5th. If you know where Harry Winston's jewelry place is, it's the next building over. It's called the Crown Building. It's got all that gold at the top of the building. And they have mostly men's apparel manufacturer showrooms in there. And Marvin's son, Jimmy, does the presentation. And all the little girls from South Carolina ask me always, is Mr. Fleischman, is he married? They love him. And also through Washington Lee, last year, the alumni office put me in touch with a man who is now president of New York Stock Exchange. He was his class of 61 here. And they did a wonderful presentation for us. We've been going there, but just the business thing. But we actually got into the boardroom, and this gentleman, his assistant, actually gave us the real business about what goes on. It was real, real cute, the way they presented it to us. And of course, it's real exciting. And if you ever watch the CNN program or the business program, when they show the close at the stock exchange, you'll see him. He's a little gray-headed fellow with the beard. Bill Johnson, he's class of 61. What else can I tell you? But more life at Washington Lee, I guess, would be nice.
You know, one thing that I'm very intrigued by in looking at the Calix, you were on the Christian Council.
Okay.
I am intrigued by that.
Well, I've done that. I also, one of my highest accomplishments in Anderson, South Carolina, I spent 3 years on the board of the Catholic school there. That's almost unheard of. But anyway, I had a friend here whose name was Harry Philpott, and I think he became a minister, or his father was a minister, I don't remember. You have to look him up. He was class of 38 or 39. Very, very nice gentleman, and I became interested with some of the things Harry did. And he thought I might be of use to him on the Christian Council. And my job mainly was to help them organize the activities that they did here, which is nothing wrong with that. And like I used to tell one of my daughters, I have 4 children. And my eldest daughter, Margaret, used to have a rough time at school. Every now and then somebody started picking on her. And when she came home one day in tears, and I said, "What's the matter, Margaret?" She said, "Daddy Reed Sherrod called me rabbi in front of everybody. Said it upset me." I said, "Well," I said, "the next time somebody says anything like that, you point a finger at him and say, roses are reddish, violets are bluish. If it hadn't been for Jesus, you'd all be Jewish." And that's sort of the way I felt about it. I mean, you know, Judaism was the foundation of the beginning of all the other religions. And I don't have any argument with any of them. I just figure that the main thing is to do good for people. I don't like for people to tell me that I don't believe correctly. And I won't tell anybody that either. But that was the thing about the Christian Council. Whatever the activities they had, it was mostly helping out the local people, fundraising, things like that. Golden, silver opportunities for the young people here at WNL. And I believed in it. That's about it. That was a... And I don't... The main things, I was on the Calix. I wrote the sports for the Calix. And I was a busy fellow. I was always doing something, and I'm still that way, which is stupid, I guess. Don't have time to smell the roses. And I look around and say, "My God, I'm 75 already. How did I get there so fast?" I stay busy.
I stay busy. I need to flip the tape over.